international loan finance, international loan syndication. We want to understand the nature and operation of the international euro loan markets, which forms one part of the larger international euro dollar markets. The euro dollar markets emerge following the Second World War, in particular after the restoration of currency convertibility in 1958. We have three principal markets. There's an underlying interbank market through which large banks operating in the London interbank markets can essentially buy and sell money between each other in foreign currencies. There is a euro loan market whereby banks come together in groups, in syndicates, so that they can make available very large volumes of funds. It's not that the banks cannot afford to participate in the syndicate and lend by themselves, it's that by becoming a member of a syndicate, they can share the credit risk, they share the exposure. And thirdly, you have a bond market so that the issuers can raise funds by way of selling a security into the market. It's an undertaking to pay. It's essentially a promissory note expressed in the form of a transferable and negotiable instrument. Negotiable means that the person acquiring the instrument can obtain a better title or perfect title so long as they had no prior notice of any defect in title. So we have the euro dollar markets made up of an underlying interbank market and a parallel loan market and a bond market. The euro dollar term itself refers to the lending and borrowing in any currency outside the country of issuance. The centre for these markets remains London, it's still London, so dealing in any currency from any other country in London would be euro dollar, dealing in sterling in London would be a domestic deal. To try and understand the nature of the transactions and the markets, we have a set of slides which reviews a number of the key points concerned. There is a supporting full chapter which reviews all of this. There is also a separate summary of the main documentation used in practice in the London markets, which is the Loan Market Association Multi-Currency Term and Revolving Facility Agreement. This is essentially the core standard document that all participants in the market will refer to in terms of constructing particular facilities for use in any specific transaction or financing arrangement. With regards to the nature of the loan market then, this is based on syndication, so we need to understand syndication, introduction and outline structure. We need to review solicitation and lead bank function. The lead bank is the arranging bank who puts the deal together. It brings the syndicate, it forms the syndicate members, it contacts them, draws them together, it drafts the documentation, has the documentation approved, and then the lead bank will depart from the transaction. On the closing, once all of the documentation is signed, there is no need then for the lead bank or the arranging bank. It takes a large percentage fee, which is a percentage of the total funds made available. It then departs. The management of the transaction is then taken over by the agent bank, so we need to understand the agent bank and its role and function as well. We will look at syndicate rules and relations. We will look at the syndicate agents, that's the agent bank, and how it manages the facility once it's all up and running, and then we'll draw some final comment and conclusions. In terms of syndicate basics, we are advancing funds on common terms under a single agreement. In practice, for example, you may have one borrower, six, let's say up to nine subsidiary borrowers, so that's 10 borrowers altogether. You may have 10 banks in the syndicate. So what you essentially have is this, it's 10 times 10. It's at minimum 100 loans. In practice, there will be multiple drawdowns over what's called a commitment or availability period, which may last for up to, let's say, 2 years or even longer, and then the borrowers can draw down possibly every month, so it then becomes a multiple of 100. So it's 100 possibly times 12 times 2. That's just for the basic facility. Very often you will attach a term facility, which is for a specific fixed duration, with a revolving facility With the term facility, once you repay, you cannot draw down again. But with the revolving facility, you repay at the end of each interest period, and then you can draw down again. So in our example, we can again then have multiple drawdowns under the revolver, repayment, and then draw down again. This might be restricted to, again, 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years, the same commitment availability period as the term loan, although the revolver might also extend for the full duration of the facility, which might be 10 years or it might be 20 years. So again, we have multiple loans. We could possibly have thousands of loans all issued on identical terms under a single loan agreement. While we only have one agreement signed between the parties, there are legally, technically, multiple separate individual loans entered into under this document, all of which is set out in the terms of the specific drawdown statement, which in the language of the LMA we refer to as a utilization request. You will complete the utilization request, which will be set out in Schedule 3 of the LMA. The borrowers simply complete the blank sections within that. They then submit that to the agent bank. The agent bank notifies each of the banks participating in the syndicate of the amount that they are due to pay for that specific period. So, for example, it might be the next 3 months, it might be in dollars, it might either be fixed or revolving interest, most commonly revolving. The agent bank will then notify each of the banks who will then pay in terms of their participation within the syndicate. The syndicate members are listed in Schedule 1, and that will record the proportion that they are liable for. They don't have to be responsible for an equal amount. So if we have, for example, $100 million, 10 banks, generally you would assume it's $10 million each. In practice, it could be any proportion that they deem or they deem appropriate and that they wish to contribute to. All that happens is when one of those borrowers wishes to draw down, they fill out the utilization request, they submit that to the agent bank, and the agent bank informs each syndicate member the proportionate amount that it's expected to make available. The core technical funding point that arises is that the banks do not actually hold the funds ready to advance under the facility. The banks will simply draw down as they need it on the interbank market supporting the euro dollar market. So, for example, for the next 3 months, one of the banks, or let's assume all of the banks, are required to pay in $1 million each. The agent bank notifies the banks of that. Only at that stage will those 10 banks then go into the interbank market, supporting the euro dollar market, and draw down £1 million, which they will then place in an account so that that's available for the agent bank. The agent bank, once they've collected all 10 portions of this 1 million, so that's 10 million, it will then transfer that over under what's called the SWIFT messaging service to the borrower concerned. The banks only draw down when they need to actually make available funds under the facility, and they only need to do that once they're actually notified of the amount that they're required to contribute for each payment period by the agent bank. So we're going to have a term loan structure. A term loan is for a fixed period, but in practice, most of these documents will also include an attached revolving facility. The key standard document that we refer to is the Loan Market Association, the Multicurrency Term and Revolving Facilities Agreement. We refer to that as the A and the B facilities. The Loan Market Association was established as a trade association in this area to bring the principal participating banks together to act as a form of industry liaison group, as well as to prepare all of this core draft documentation. The LMA is based in London. It was originally set up in 1996 and now has, I think it's 500 or 600 members altogether. It's actually based at the offices of, or was based at the offices of Clifford Chance, which was LMA's legal counsel. A number of the largest law firms then came together with Clifford Chance to prepare standard documentation that creates the form of the multi-currency standard term and revolving facility that we are looking at. Essentially, during the 1960s and 1970s, a large number of standard terms emerged through the work of the large law firms involved in this area. So all that simply happened was they consolidated all of the terms and prepared a draft standard set of reconciled, restated, consolidated terms and conditions for use in all documentation going forward. That's the basis for the standard term and revolving facility agreement that we are considering. The LMA itself, its key activities include the provision of recommended documentation for primary and secondary syndicate loan markets and loan members. The primary market is entering into the loan itself. The secondary market is making available transfers of the loans. While transfers historically were not possible of personal debt obligations, we then develop legal assignment and then equitable assignment. Legal assignment is provided for under Section 136 of the Law of Property Act 1925. The assignment has to be in writing. It has to be for a fixed unconditional amount, and you have to give notice to the debtor. In practice, the banks will not want to give notice, and also because of some of the other key provisions in the documentation, the amount will not be fixed and unconditional. It might still be revolving, and there may be conditions attached, for example, including sales restrictions, for example, in the United States. You cannot then have a legal assignment under the Law of Property Act, so you have an equitable assignment. The difficulty with an equitable assignment is that you can lose priorities if another assignee receives the transfer and then gives notice to the borrower first. In practice, however, that will rarely, if almost never, happen, simply because these are closed transactions with large borrowing groups, either corporate or governments, working with a small group of professional lenders in the Eurodollar markets. Everyone knows everybody else. These are small, closed transactions, so the fact that you're relying on equitable rather than legal assignment will not cause any difficulties. Specific forms of transfer certificate are provided under the standard LMA agreement. That's actually set out in Schedule 5. Schedule 5 operates by way of a novation. A novation means that you can transfer rights and obligations. In law, you can strictly only transfer the benefits through assignment, legal or equitable. If you want to transfer obligations, the lending obligations, you would have to do that through novation. Under the more recent revisions to the LMA standard documentation, there is now a separate assignment included as Schedule 6. What's also happened in practice is that to create this secondary loan market, we also have other specific types of certificates. We talk about, for example, transferable loan instruments and transferable loan certificates. A TLI is an assignment and a TLC is a novation. Transferable loan instruments are assignments, transferable loan certificates are novations. This then creates a secondary market in these participations, which is each of the syndicate members selling on their rights and obligations under the documentation. This creates a secondary market in loan transfers, which parallels the operation of the bond market in the capital market area. To go back to the key functions of the LME, the LME drafts, prepares standard documentation for use in both the primary and the secondary markets. It establishes key market practice, key market standards. It provides educational and training facilities in Europe, the Middle East and Africa. It also supports collective lobbying, dealing with governments and regulatory authorities in the financial area, and it provides additional networking opportunities. The advantages of having a trade association involved in this area are that this allows for more efficient execution of primary and secondary loan business and loan documentation. This increases liquidity consequently in both the primary and secondary markets. This improves the ability of institutions to manage their loan portfolios more efficiently and effectively, essentially due to the liquidity and the transferability created. We can reduce costs by virtue of developing a collective approach to all common issues, which then means more funds can be raised at lower overall cost. This also permits a timely exchange of views and the circulation of relevant information and comment. We have a dedicated website and support documents to make available necessary ancillary services to support all of this other work and effort. As we've already mentioned, specific dedicated education and training courses are provided, with a wide range of other documentation made available through the LMA website. We also then have an opportunity to participate in other current issues and problem solving, which ties back with the lobbying we mentioned before. The LMA operates through a number of subgroups as well as subcommittees. It, for example, had an agency committee, a distressed debt committee, a documentation committee, loan operations committee, a par trading practices committee, and a taxation committee. A large number of different types of documents are made available, and you can see that through simply accessing the documentation section on the LMA website. So, we then have the term loan structure supported by a revolving facility, and we also have the bank syndicate members. So we then have to consider the relationship between the syndicate members, which we express in terms of a number of key rules. So the course syndication documentation will consist of a term sheet, a mandate letter, an information memorandum, and then the course syndication rules we can summarise in terms of equality, severality, proportionality, syndicate democracy, and limited agency function. The three core documents, the term sheet acts as a summary of the deal. When the lead bank and the arranging bank is negotiating with the other banks to try and involve them, to encourage them to participate in the facility, it will prepare an outline of all of the key terms and conditions. At the beginning of this market, this could have been very short. It might only have been one page, possibly two pages, just to outline the core, principally financial terms, and then any special provisions. In practice, what now happens is that the term sheet effectively acts as a summary of the final loan document. It will basically follow the same headings, the same structure, and it will refer to all of the key provisions. Under almost all financial documents, we have the financial terms, we have the obligations, and we have the default provisions. The financials, the obligations, and the defaults, FOD, FOD. The financials will set out the amount, the interest, the term, repayment, and prepayment. Prepayment is when you pay early. The obligations consist principally of three forms: the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and then the continuing covenants. And then you also have a series of default provisions which set out the terms under which the documentation will be cancelled, and this is reflected in the key provisions set out in the standard documentation. In my text, I summarise these in terms of suspension of further drawdown, cancellation of all drawdown, acceleration of repayment, and then rescission, where you cancel the loan documentation altogether, and then damages. You sue in court for damages. So the term sheet then acts as a summary loan document which sets out all of the principal terms and conditions that will apply. The mandate letter is the letter of instruction that the lead bank obtains from the borrower and the borrower's group. The information memorandum is a separate document which supports the facility and explains, by providing all of the necessary information and data to the syndicate members, as to the condition of the borrower the use and application of the funds and how the funds will be repaid over time. It's basically, essentially provides all of the necessary background information to allow the syndicate members to decide, to determine whether they would like to participate in this specific facility and how much they would like to contribute to this, which is their proportionate contribution, as well as for them to then agree the appropriate interest rate. All of that will be assessed as part of this credit assessment process, which will be based on all of the detail set out in the information memorandum. The information memorandum will be prepared by the lead bank, the arranging bank, in association with the borrowers. The key issue that arises is ensuring that it is accurate and there is no misrepresentation. We do not want any innocent, negligent, fraudulent misrepresentation, because that will then create liability on behalf of the lead bank, the arranging bank, although there's a series of standard exclusion and limited duty or basis clauses we can also incorporate to limit that, which we deal with later. As we've said, the core syndicate rules, which express the relationship between the parties, are based on equality. All of the banks which are members of the syndicate have equal rights and entitlements. Severality. Their obligations are several. If one of them doesn't want to lend or cannot lend, in the specific provision, for example, for illegality, if illegality arises, one of the banks simply notifies the agent bank, they can no longer participate, they are automatically withdrawn from any future involvement. Because the terms and conditions and the relationship, the responsibility is several and not joint and several, none of the other banks are required to make up the gap. So if our total available funding then drops from 100 million to 90 million, the other banks do not have to cover the difference, cover that gap. All that will happen in practice is that the agent bank will try to find another participating bank that can come in and make up the shortfall. Proportionality, we've already mentioned, the syndicate members contribute in proportion to their agreed commitments. That will be set out in the schedule. The schedules list the participant members with a note of the amount that they will make available. Syndicate democracy, because they are equal and because everything is several and proportional, decisions are taken on a democratic basis. In practice, for important matters, it will be unanimous. It will be full consensus. There may be some more limited majority voting provided on less important terms and conditions, although in practice even that will be 66 and two-thirds rather than a simple 50% majority. Because of all of this, there is also then limited delegation of function, and the limited delegation of function corresponds with the specific more administrative role and duties of the agent bank, which corresponds with their limited functions in terms of wider executive and discretionary control, which would otherwise or could have been delegated by the syndicate. Because the syndicate does not want to delegate these wider discretionary important decision-taking functions, the residual responsibilities of the agent bank are then much more limited. The two correspond. We can then express this again. In some of the books, in looking at the nature of the syndicate, there's reference to several commitments, bank administrative convenience, syndicate democracy with limited majority control, pro rata sharing. I simply take those ideas, I restate them in terms of severality, equality, proportionality, syndicate democracy, and limited agency function. We have several obligations with divided rights, full equality with pro rata sharing, restricted commitments and equal rights, limited delegation of function. There will be only restricted areas of waiver. There will be materiality imposed on representations, as well as an additional adverse change clause. And then we have the enforcement provisions, including acceleration and directions. There's very limited delegation of the larger, important decisions which the banks want to reserve to themselves. The consequence of that is that we've limited responsibilities delegated to the agent bank. The documentation itself then. So the lead bank is going to solicit interest from potential participants. This is the role and function of the lead bank, which we can then express having regard again to the key documents. The term sheet will set out the amount, the term, payment and repayment, interest, including the margin. The margin is the bank's profit. In practice, what will happen is, and this is provided for under section 9.1 in brackets, 9.1 of the LME standard term agreement. The banks determine their profit, that's the margin. The borrower then pays the cost of the bank's funding plus the margin and any additional amounts. The cost of funding will be expressed in terms of the local interbank reference rate. This used to be calculated with regards to virtually all of the main international loan documentation in terms of LIBOR. That's the London Interbank Offered Rate. As a result of difficulties that arose during and following the global financial crisis, the authorities became concerned that some of the figures quoted to make up the panel data that was collected to calculate the daily LIBOR rates was inaccurate. Essentially, what had been happening was that Barclays Bank had slightly overstated its submissions to the LIBOR panel, which then distorted the LIBOR rates so that the rates did not provide a true position as to the expected interbank cost of funding for that period. In practice, the way the system works is this. LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate, is calculated in 5 currencies for 75 maturity bands. For example, 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, 3 months, 1 month. That then creates 35 total reference figures. There was 18 participant banks, and these would report their figures daily in terms of the expected amount that they could borrow on the interbank markets on an overnight unsecured basis. So each of the main banks, that's the largest banks operating in London, 18 of them would report the amount that they expected to be able to borrow at overnight on a one-day unsecured basis. They report this to the British Bankers Association, the BBA. The BBA would take these 18 figures, it removes the highest 4, it removes the lowest 4, and it calculates the average from the gap, the 10 that are left. This is how you would calculate the daily LIBOR rate. The difficulty that arose was that because Barclays Bank had slightly distorted its contribution, it is unclear whether that actually had any impact, but because there was a perceived defect in the calculation of the system, it was decided that they would abandon this, although it would then take another 8 years, almost 10 years, to implement this in practice. The then chairman of the Financial Conduct Authority, Martin Wheatley, conducted a review in 2012 and recommended significant revision. Responsibility for calculating the interbank reference rates was taken off the British Bankers Association. It was transferred to the authorities. The authorities then wanted to appoint other agencies to manage this. The BBA's role was then replaced by the ICE, the International Continental Exchange, while further discussions took place on the establishment of new rates. What was decided in London specifically was to move on to a new interbank reference rate called SONIA. SONIA is the sterling overnight rate, which is now prepared by the Bank of England, and all of the major institutions in London have been encouraged in the strongest of terms, although there was very substantial delays, to transfer from LIBOR to SONIA. Other major international financial centres already had their own reference rates, although these have been revised and strengthened. In the United States, we now use SOFR, S-O-F-R, is the Secured Overnight Funding Financing Rate. In Tokyo, we had TIBOR, we now also have TONBAR. In Shanghai, we have SHIBOR. In Hong Kong, we have HIBOR. In Europe, they had EURIBOR, and then EONIA, and now they use ESTR, which is the European short-term rate. each of the main financial centres then has a official reference rate to which they will apply standard documentation, which determines the average cost of funding for banks operating in the interbank markets in that area. As we've already explained, the banks do not lend under the Eurodollar markets using deposited funds and the funds that they have in reserve. They will only go into the markets and draw down funds as they need it. Their cost of funds is then calculated with regards to that local interbank reference rate. In London, it's now SONIA in place of LIBOR. Because of delays in transferring existing contracts, converting them from LIBOR to new rates, as I said, the negotiations took around 10 years altogether. The authorities in London announced that LIBOR would no longer apply from the beginning of 2022. LIBOR essentially ceased on 31 December 2021. There is some provision in more difficult cases for the use of synthetic LIBOR rates, but generally LIBOR has been abandoned and all institutions are meant to convert to the relevant local rate. In London, it's now SONIA. The difficulty has been still converting payments under all of these old outstanding contracts. There was, for example, over $350 trillion of derivatives contracts denominated in LIBOR, and the difficulty was transferring those to one or more of the new reference rates. We then have the fees. There's three principal sets of fees. There was called a commitment fee, there's an arrangement fee, and there's an agent fee, agency fee. The commitment fee is the amount that the borrowers have to pay to each of the banks for making available the commitment. This is usually quite small. This will be calculated in our example with regards to the contribution of each of the banks. So it's 10 million out of a 100 million facility, each one of 10 banks contributing a tenth, 10 million each. So the commitment fee is a percentage of that commitment for making those funds available. It's quite small. And all that simply happens is as the borrower draws down, that is then converted into the interest rate, which is based on the local interbank offered rate, as we've explained. The arrangement fee is the fee that the lead bank or arranging bank receives. As I've already explained, this will be a percentage of the total commitment. Most of these rates, including the interest rates, are expressed in terms of BPS, which are basis points. Basis points is 0.01. It's essentially 1%. So, for example, the commitment fee might be 10-15 basis points, that's 0.1 or 0.15. The arranging fee may be 120 basis points or 125, that's 1.25 of a $100 million facility. The third fee is the agent's fee, the agency fee. This is usually much smaller. Again, this will be standard fixed fees having regard to the role and function because they're essentially only carrying out administrative duties. This will be much smaller than the arranging fee received by the agent bank. In practice, what also then happens is this. The borrower is going to pay the local interbank reference rate plus the margin. And the margin might be 100, 200, even 300 basis points, full 3%, or even more, depending upon the risk, depending upon the circumstances, depending upon the financial condition of the borrower and the nature of the application of the funding, the purpose for which the monies are being raised. What will also then happen is this. The borrower is going to pay a number of other additional amounts. I have prepared a separate outline summary of the key provisions in the LMA standard documentation. We can reduce this to 4 pages and then we can print this 1 page front and back with 2 pages per side. We can then see from that all of the other additional charges that the borrower will pay in addition to the margin and the basic LIBOR rate as provided for under section 9.1. There's a whole series, anything between 12 and 15, maybe 16 plus, separate other charges that the borrowers pay during the term of the facility. The first specific amount is referred to as a mandatory cost. The mandatory cost is actually itself provided for under Section 9.1c of the LMA Standard Agreement. The mandatory cost is a very small amount calculated on the basis of the size of the facility that's paid to the local regulatory agent. In London, a very small amount will be paid to the Bank of England, and a very small amount divided between the Prudential Regulation Authority and the Financial Conduct Authority, the two regulatory agents. There used to be a standard form for this, although because it became much more complicated to calculate, the LMA no longer makes this available. It's a very small amount. It will be 0.0 something of a percentage. It's essentially just to pay what effectively amounts to running costs for the local monetary and regulatory agents managing this specific market. That's the mandatory cost. We will also then see you have the margin and the LIBOR with the mandatory cost. You've then got the fees in section 12. You've got tax grossing up and indemnities in section 13. You've increased costs in section 14. You've other indemnities in section 15, including currency, other indemnities, and an indemnity to the agent bank. You've then also got other costs and expenses, transaction expenses, amendment costs, and enforcement costs set out in section 17. So all of these additional charges and subcharges, and there's a series of, for example, on the tax, a series of other subpayments there, all of this will be paid by the borrowers. So if you're advising the borrower what's the total cost of the facility, it's not simply the interbank reference rate and the bank's margin, it's all of these other charges as well. On tax grossing up, the banks expect to receive payments free of any withholding tax. In most cases, local jurisdictions will not impose a withholding tax because they want to encourage this type of lending and to make these types of funds available. Where a withholding tax is imposed, what happens is that the amount that the borrower is paying is grossed up so that the banks receive the original net payment that they expected. If, for example, a 10% withholding is imposed on a 100 unit payment, to gross up 100 to pay 10, you don't increase the payment to 110. If you go up to 110, 10% of 110 is 11. 11 from 110 is 99. The banks would only have received 99. If you're grossing up 100 with a 10% withholding, you gross up to 111. You take 10% of 111 is 11. 11 from 111 leaves 100. So the banks receive the net payment that they expected. So all of this will be set out in the term sheet and summarised so that the borrower knows exactly the terms and conditions that they are entering into, and the banks have a summary statement of all of their rights and entitlements under the documentation. All of this will then be transferred into the final loan documentation prepared, which may also include, in addition to all of the standard provisions, any other special terms and loan basics. All of this is made subject to contract and practice. There is a legal presumption that parties are entering into legally enforceable agreements when they are negotiating. That's, for example, set out in Branca versus Cabada, 1947, King's Bench 854. Because of that presumption of legal intent, you will specify that all documentation is subject to contract, which means it does not have any legal effect until final agreement has been entered into and the final terms and conditions have been signed. In terms of the lead bank's functions, it's going to prepare the information memorandum, it solicits expressions of interest, it negotiates the term of the loan agreement. With regards to the lead bank function, roles and duties, we can then expand this further. So we look at its appointment and capacity. We've already referred to the functions: prepare the information memorandum, solicit expressions of interest, negotiate the term loan. Liability, we need to consider possible regulatory liability. An aspect of this is promotion, that's advertising, that's section 21 of the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000. All promotions in the United Kingdom must be fair, clear and not misleading. Section 21 specifically requires that all advertisements are either issued or approved by an authorised person. That then means that the authorised person must either draft the advertisements or it must confirm that they comply with all of the relevant conditions that are otherwise imposed under the UK regulated regime. It's quite a simple drafting technique solution. You simply specify that all advertisements must be issued or approved by an authorised person, which then means that authorised person must ensure that the promotions comply with all of the relevant provisions. The key requirement, the key obligation, is that they must be clear, fair and not misleading, Section 21 of the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000. We also then have misrepresentation. There must not be innocent, negligent or fraudulent misrepresentation, as well as statutory deceit under the Theft Act. Limitation, we can control exclusion clauses. We can have exclusion provisions directly, which simply state that the lead bank and the agent bank will not be liable for any losses covered. These are however, subject to separate restrictions. In particular, under the Misrepresentation Act 1967, which imports the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977 into the area of misrepresentation, which essentially imposes a reasonableness test on the determination as to whether any restrictions are reasonable. Even if we have exclusion clauses and we comply with the restrictions on the extent of the exclusion, even if they are declared in any particular case to be unenforceable for whatever reason, the agent bank and the lead bank can also still take a residual indemnity, so that even if they pay out, they can be compensated separately. And then we have the remedies. I've referred to them here as rescission, default and damages, although, as I've explained already, technically there's suspension, there's acceleration, cancellation, acceleration, rescission and damages. In terms of liability, we can have misrepresentation under common law. So we have fraudulent and we have negligent misrepresentation. We can then have statutory misrepresentation, so it's deceit under the Theft Act, Section 19. That's where a corporate body engages in a deceit of a form. So there can be statutory deceit under the Theft Act. And then you have statutory misrepresentation under Section 67 of, under the 1967 Misrepresentation Act, Section 21. The purpose of the Misrepresentation Act was to try to remove the difficulties that had earlier arisen in attempting to enforce the common law provisions with fraudulent and negligent misrepresentation. They essentially wanted to reverse the burden of proof, which would otherwise apply, so that you didn't have to establish full fraudulent misrepresentation. If you establish misrepresentation, the burden of responsibility then transfers to the other party, who have to confirm that they have satisfied a reasonable defence, there was a reasonable belief that something was true. So you have this defence which effectively reverses the burden of proof in practice. The effect was to try and remove the earlier difficulties that arose in enforcing common law provisions in practice. Overall, what happens is the Misrepresentation Act 1967 will apply the general provisions set out in the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977, which imports this reasonableness test. The key point that then arises simply is that because these are large professional wholesale markets, we're dealing with governments and some of the largest companies in the world as borrowers, and then some of the largest banks and securities firms as lenders, the sense of reasonableness, the level of reasonableness, is adjusted to reflect the fact that these are all expert professional counterparties dealing in a wholesale professional market. There may be some other issues of regulatory liability that arise. So under the Financial Services and Markets Act, we need to be careful that we need to take care to ensure that we do not breach the general prohibition in Section 19 that provides that you shall not carry on a regulated activity in the UK unless you are authorised or exempt. A regulated activity is defined by order in section 22 of the Financial Services and Markets Act. By order means by direction of the Treasury. So we have a separate regulated activities order, RAO 2001, as amended. There is a short schedule which lists the key investment and investment activities in Schedule 2 to the FSMA. Technically, this is only illustrative because the Act applies to regulated activities which are defined in the RAO. The RAO is around 200 pages as amended. We also have the permission requirement in Section 20. In addition to being generally authorised, you must have specific permission to carry on the particular activity involved. And then we have the restriction on promotion and marketing. That's section 21 we've referred to already. In practice, the FSME will apply to deposit taking, which is the equivalent of banking. We don't define banking directly. We have deposit taking as originally provided for under the Banking Act 1979, and then the Banking Act 1987. Deposit taking corresponds with the definition of credit institution under the First Banking Directive 1977, Second Banking Directive 1989, and then the Capital Requirements Directive, and then Capital Consolidated Banking Directive 2000, 2006, and then the new Capital Requirements Directives 2014. This essentially means that you receive repayable funds from the general public and lend on own account. Credit institutions, deposit taking, are defined in terms of both receiving repayable funds from the public and lending on own account. In the euro dollar markets, because the lending commitments are not funded by underlying deposits, but simply through interbank borrowing on the interbank market supporting the Eurodollar market, this does not constitute deposit taking. So strictly, this is not a regulated activity. Participating in the Eurodollar markets of itself through the participation in these syndicates will not of itself constitute a regulated activity. There are some qualifications that can arise in this area. There is some case law, I think it was the Fonds decision, which indicated that debenture could include a loan agreement or entering into a loan agreement, although that's generally not considered a major difficulty in practice. The position was that adopted by almost all of the main law firms was that, and based on the legal advice that they had provided to the extent necessary from barristers, was that entering into the loan agreement of itself was not acknowledging indebtedness of itself. The indebtedness is only created when you draw down under the loan agreement. So therefore, that's not a debenture, so it can constitute a security, so therefore, securities regulations would not apply. At the same time, because you're not borrowing from the general public, you're only drawing down funds on the interbank markets from other wholesale institutions, that's not from the general public, so again, that's not banking business. In practice, it is generally understood that there will be no core regulatory provisions, although the particular circumstances of every deal have to be considered to ensure that we do not breach either sections 19, 20 or 21. There's a general duty disclosure, more to do with securities activities in section 80. Compensation can be payable under section 90. There was misleading statements, that was formerly 397. That's now been reset under the Financial Services Act 2012. I think it's sections 88 and 90. With a reformulated set of provisions, we also had the market abuse clause in the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000. That was section 119. This was essentially to try and create an intermediate offence below insider trading or insider dealing, which is a criminal offence under the Criminal Justice Act. They wanted to create a civil offence which had a lower balance of probability rather than higher full standard of proof that would apply in a criminal case. They created this civil, quasi-civil market abuse offence. that was then adopted within the European Union under the terms of the Market Abuse Directive and Regulation. Once the Market Abuse Regulation came into effect, which partly includes market abuse as well as insider trading, insider dealing, other misconduct, because the regulation was directly applicable, Section 118 was removed because it was no longer necessary. And following the UK withdrawal from the European Union, all that has happened is that the market abuse regulation has been onboarded into UK law. So the market abuse provisions are now in the onboarded UK equivalent of the market abuse regulation. Most of these provisions will not generally apply, but we simply have to monitor them. We have to be aware of them so that this does not cause any difficulty in a particular case. I have simply summarised some of the key case law that applies with regards to these different offences. So we have intentional deceit by an officer of a body corporate under Section 19 of the Theft Act. We had R versus Kislin, R versus Bushungrian. Prospectus gave false impression as it had not disclosed secret reserves. The finance was attempt to corner the world pepper market that had not been properly disclosed. Therefore, there was an offence under the Theft Act for intentional deceit. With fraudulent misrepresentation, Derry versus Peak, 1889, 14 appeal cases, you can get damages and rescission. In practice, the banks always want the right to rescind. If they have rescission, it puts them in a much stronger position in negotiating with clients. Specifically, this arises with regards to the drafting of the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and the default provisions. I deal with this in the chapter in further detail. Representation is only a statement of fact rather than opinion or law. A warranty is an undertaking to act in a certain way. Representations are not full conditions in a contract. So what we're trying to do is this. Because of that, we don't have the right to rescission. If there's breach, we only get damages. In practice, what we do is this. We do two things. We elevate representations and warranties to try and make them the same effect in law. Because the representations are not legal conditions and they're only statements of fact rather than opinion or law, we elevate. So we represent and warrant, or we give the following representations and warranties. The objective of that language is to elevate representations to the same status as warranties. However, that may still not give us rescission. So what we then do is we tie those into the events of default so that in the event of breach of a representation or warranty, that constitutes full default and we have rescission, which gives the banks the additional negotiating power and position that they are looking for. This raises some quite subtle points of law, but they're important in practice and finance lawyers should be aware of these. With regards to fraudulent misrepresentation, the general test established, Derry versus Peak, is knowledge of falsity or reckless not caring whether something was true or false. We also then have negligent misrepresentation in common law. So there was Headley Byrne versus Healer Partners. This is the main case. This was a legal case. There had to be some special duty, some special relationship to create full remedies and to have an implied duty for negligent misrepresentation. We also have Caparo Industries versus Dickman. In that case, the auditors were held not liable. We then attempt to strengthen the effect of both the common law and the limitations in the Earlier Theft Act. So we have the Misrepresentation Act 1967. So we're going to have civil liability. We have damages for misrepresentation. That's the new statutory form of misrepresentation, unless subject to this new defence that we've incorporated, which effectively reverses the burden of proof, which would otherwise apply in a fraud case. So it's unless there was reasonable ground for belief and actual belief that the fact was true, or the statement was true. So we create this reasonable belief defence, which effectively reverses the burden of proof from earlier fraud cases in Derry versus Peak. We can also have, and this is the most common form, innocent misrepresentation, where parties simply were not aware and it's not particularly severe or serious, in that case there's no action for damages unless this had been incorporated as a full contractual term. For example, Gilchester Properties versus GOM. That's what we're talking about in terms of elevating representations and warranties, to equate those two and then raising them to full conditions, so that if there was breach, you have full remedies with damages and rescission. How do we control liability in practice? There was a famous decision of Ray Colquitrona's tanker litigation in 1976. This involved a North American banking corporation. The syndicate banks in that case sued the lead bank, and in that case the lead bank settled. The argument was that the lead bank had expert knowledge about the market and that of the appropriate terms and conditions that should have been applied, because it had not failed, in the opinion of the other members of the syndicate, to have taken reasonable care, the bank was liable. This caused substantial concern in the lending markets, in particular in London, and for that reason a lot of attention would subsequently focus on the drafting of exclusion clauses to limit liability of principally the lead bank or the arranging bank as well as the agent bank. Under general contractual provisions, you can exclude liability. We simply have to construe them properly and we will limit the exclusion. It's referred to further below. We have contra profferentem. That means that if one party is trying to exclude liability, the clause in the event of an uncertainty will be interpreted against the party trying to draft and rely on it. So contra profferentem, against your interests. So we simply can enforce these provisions, although we will apply a negative interpretation and construction doctrine, whereby we favour the parties who did not draft the clause. Exclusion itself, these are basis clauses. What we can do is this: we can have no duty clauses. If we limit the duty of the arranging bank and the agent bank, they then cannot be held liable for breach if there was no original duty. So there will be clauses in the documentation that provide, for example, that each of the banks in the syndicate membership will conduct their own credit assessments, their own credit evaluations. They will be responsible for their own information collection and examination, and they will not ask for any approval or any advice from either the lead bank or the agent bank. So what we're doing is this. These are called basis, or in my language, in my chapter, no duty clauses. What we're simply doing is we're clarifying the scope of duty, so that if the duty is narrower, there cannot be breach of anything outside that narrow restated scope of responsibility. We cannot have limitation clauses. Going back to point one, we can enforce exclusion clauses under general standard case law, Photo Productions and the other principal decisions in this area. That does not, however, apply to five key areas. If there's criminal liability, you cannot exclude for that. Fraudulent misrepresentation, you cannot exclude for. Statutory liability in the financial area, this is specifically now set out in section 137D of the Financial Services Act. If you breach any of the rules issued under the Act, you can be held liable for statutory liability. We have the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977, which imports this reasonableness test, although the reasonableness test of itself is then reassessed having regard to the wholesale professional nature of these markets, and then the Misrepresentation Act. There's specific controls there as to what you can exclude and not exclude. For our purposes, this generally simply imports the reasonableness provision from the Unfair Contract Terms Act. Having regard to the specific role and function of the agent bank. So, we will appoint the agent bank. The agent is of the banks and not the borrowers. Its key functions are, and this is essentially, this corresponds with the limited delegation of functions as provided for by the syndicate members. So, we can summarise these in terms of paying agency duties, conditions precedent, receipt duties, banking duties, monitoring duties and other default duties. the Asian bank does not want to assume any wider discretion and control over the facility, including specifically in the event of difficulties arising. It only wants to act as a medium to essentially convey, transfer information, notifications and payments between the syndicate banks and the borrowers. It only receives a small administrative payment, therefore it does not want to assume any wider liability beyond that. So the same provisions then apply in dealing with the Asian bank as applied with regards to the lead bank. The same provisions apply with the Asian bank and the lead and arranging bank. So liability, limitation and remedies. All that might happen is, with regards to the Asian bank, we also have to consider agency liability as well as possibly fiduciary liability, which is a higher form of agency responsibility. So again, I've just summarised some of the case law that would otherwise apply if we did not have these exclusion clauses in operation. So the agent bank must act subject to contract, Turpin versus Bilton, Frey versus Vull. There can be no delegation, Sims versus Britain. And then in higher standard situations, we may even consider the agent not simply to an agent, but also a fiduciary. We then have an even more severe set of additional standards which apply on top of that in terms of the duty of care they have to exercise. So we have no conflict of interest, Aberdeen Railway versus Blakey, no secret profit and full due diligence. Phipps versus Boardman was interesting because they had to disgorge the profits even though the parties concerned were trying to act in the best interest of the beneficiary. There was still breach and there was still disgorgement. This simply summarises the case law that would otherwise apply in relation to determining the scope and role and function of an agent as well as a higher duty fiduciary. Again, we can consider this with regards to how we can limit. So, general application of contract law, including full validity of exclusion clauses, apart from strict interpretation. That's the contra profferentum provision. These clauses are not void at common law and they will bind. We simply exclude them from application in particular cases, and then we apply the same general provisions, the same general controls and limitations that would otherwise arise with regards to excluding provisions with regards to the lead bank and the arranging bank. We will see specifically in the LMA itself, for example, much of this is set out in section 26. It specifically states that in 26.4, there are no fiduciary duties owed by either the arranging bank or the Asian bank. What will also happen is that it specifically provides that the Asian bank has no duties of any form to the other parties, so that we can restrict its possible scope of liability. If we limit the amount of functions it's otherwise responsible for, there can be no breach if there is no original duty. So I call these no duty clauses. They're also referred to as basis clauses in the provisions. And in the case law, I have included separate references, separate materials, dealing with the law of set-off and some of the most recent interesting cases in this area which look at these basis clause provisions and operations. Syndicated lending markets are then of absolutely fundamental importance in modern markets. So syndication is the key function of modern financial loan structures. The objective is to spread financial risk in the form of credit exposure and possible cost of regulatory capital compliance. The key principle simply is that you're allocating costs to the party, or allocating possible loss first to the borrowers and then to the party most liable to assume responsibility for that. The basic mechanism involves the appointment of a lead bank and a syndicate bank, but with limited management and administrative functions, as we've already explained. The lead bank is also referred to as the arranging bank. This is based on a number of key principles, including in terms of the relationship between the syndicate members, equality and severality, proportionality, limited democracy, and then restricted agency function, which corresponds with the specific five sets of rules and duties of the agent bank. the legal and commercial effect of all of this is to allow the banks to monitor and manage the loan directly and exercise their rights and protections accordingly. The core underlying objective is for the banks to have maximum control without becoming, for example, what we refer to as shadow directors. The banks do not want to conduct the day-to-day business of the borrowers, because then they could be held liable for any misconduct that the borrower or other breaches that the borrowers engage in or enter into. The banks want as much control, but without becoming directly liable for the daily functions. We do that principally through the provision of information under all the information clauses as set out in the loan documentation, specifically in the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and then the continuing covenants. We also get additional specific control through the use of the financial covenants in particular, for example, the minimum net worth clauses, MNW, the earnings before tax, depreciation and amortization, that's the EBITDA, consolidated net debt, dividend payment restrictions, cash retention controls and leverage ratios. These of themselves give the banks very considerable control over the activities of the borrowers, but without themselves then becoming liable for the conduct of the borrowers. The art of drafting is then to try to ensure that the banks and the bank syndicate can have as much information and oversight as possible with as much indirect control as possible without actually creating any separate forms of liability in themselves. If the banks can be satisfied that their interests are properly respected and protected, they can then clearly lend more and at lower cost, which then benefits everyone else in this market. The other key point to highlight again is that all of this can then be managed most effectively going forward by having standard core terms and conditions in each of these key financial markets prepared by the core appointed trade association in each market, in the loan market, in the capital market, in the derivatives market. This then of itself creates very substantial certainty and common sets of protections, which again allow all of the parties to then understand their rights, duties and obligations, which of itself creates very substantial amounts of additional certainty, which can increase the liquidity in the markets and reduce the cost of borrowing to everyone's benefit.